You're listening to The Threshing Floor.
Welcome once again to The Threshing Floor. My name's Randy Moggins. This is part three, the final part of the three-part series called The Fall. This one has been a long while coming, largely because it is a very complex, dense subject that required a considerable amount of detailed research and a lot of time spent really just seeking the spirit on how to present this. And what information to present, because it is a subject that is just loaded with all kinds of data and all kinds of paths that we can go down. Our purpose in doing the three-part series was to reframe the Genesis narrative from a standpoint that would bring it into a more modern understanding. As such, we framed Genesis from a mythological standpoint, which I believe is correct, gave it a backdrop a little more appropriate to the understanding that we have in the 21st century, and prophetically brought it forward to weave it into the material that we've been presenting on this show and on the off-planet radio shows as well. First, let me take a second to say thank you to those who continue to support, those who continue to communicate, those who send letters, cards, gifts, emails, criticisms. Your participation is important because it validates that what we do touches you. And it may touch you in a way that makes you angry or disoriented or causes you to doubt certain things. Our purpose is to bring clarity. Our purpose is to share information, and our purpose is to make living and real what is written in the scriptures in a way that's non-religious. So the third part of The Fall, this is actually almost a month overdue, and some of that is due to, first off, the fact that in the month of October I traveled extensively, and secondly, it took some time to get this show together. The third thing is that, like everything human, I occasionally fall prey to the physical things of this world, and I have been for many weeks now kind of nursing a back injury that I suffered early in the month of November as a result of an ice storm here, and I had to remove ice from some structures around our property, and I wound up injuring my back. So I've been kind of battling that. I'm coming back thanks to some people who are working with me. There's a great deal of healing. God is abundant and does keep his promise. He does heal. And he heals through us. He heals through the energetics that we manifest in this physical dimension by spiritual power. And some of that streams as well into what we're going to study, because spiritual power has to do with your ability to discern and withstand the onslaught of the dark side. So this series that I'm into is probably the most difficult and controversial, again, that I've done in the entire period of Threshing Floor, over 8 years. It's controversial because of aspects of ancient human origins, certainly from the perspective of the biblical narratives. And so this study is an assimilation of a lot of different information, not just from Scripture, but overlapping it. We're going to talk about genetics again. We're going to talk about the assimilation of human genetics into the pantheon of non-human, off-world, or even extra-dimensional beings, known variously as the Nephilim, Fallen Ones, or Shining Ones, the Watchers, or the Anunnaki. We're going to be in Genesis 6 in the Bible for this, and we'll bring in some other information as well. Again, it's useful to understand that we are not attempting to undermine the authority of what was written in the Bible so much as to reframe it in a wider context, which I believe is accurate both historically and spiritually. I think too many times literal fundamentalism, biblical Christianity, has been snared by its own limited scope and vision. So in dissecting Genesis chapter 6 alone, we are given pretty scant information as to the identity of these beings called the sons of God. Strict literal biblical interpretation using only the transliterated English term, sons of God, is confounded by its usage in the Old Testament versus its usage in the New Testament. And I think the two are very distinct. And I think it has something as well to do with a shifting identification between the terms appearances in Genesis 6:2 and the last mention in John 3:2. This term appears first in Genesis 6:2, quote, "The sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose." We've previously examined this topic on the Threshing Floor back in 2009 with my guest Paul Sandu in a 7-part series that we did called The Chronology of Creation. We discussed this in the part 7 of that series. And I'll put a link up with this. You can go back, you can look at it, you can listen to the evidence for yourself. It was a very good study. I deeply respect Paul Sandu's work and position, but I strongly disagree with his literal interpretations regarding the sons of God in the Old Testament. I did spend considerable time deliberating on a wide set of data before launching into this present study, and I communicated with Paul Sandu a bit on this as well. Paul's indicated to me that he will not abandon his literal biblical understanding of this, therefore he has tended to weigh towards the semantics that are given in Bible rather than looking outside of the Bible itself for corroborating evidence. It's not a criticism of Paul personally. I think it's a very narrow view. So I've spent a lot of time this year outlining why I believe this fundamentalist view is not only in error, but is in fact a deception by the Roman Church patriarchs to hide vital information which they deemed to be dangerous or heretical. So for this audience in this study, I leave the arguments aside. The antiquity of the Book of Enoch and Yasher is sufficient to allow them to inform our studies and provide key elements which do not exist in the present compilation of the Holy Bible. The term sons of God in Genesis 6 is translated from the Hebrew text where it is rendered as Ben Elohim. In part one of this series, I outlined the delegation of the creation by the one God, the creator of all, to a group of higher beings called the Elohim. These are those who said, "Let us create man in our image." That's Genesis 1:26. The plural there is inescapable. The plural there can't be elegantly hidden by the single rendering of the word God in Genesis chapter 1. Once one delves down with any intent at all, you're going to begin to discover that there is a pluralistic entity presented here. Some have presented this as the triune aspect of God, being the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit present in creation. I don't think I'd so much argue with that as I would that there's another dynamic that's occurring. And the word Elohim is unmistakably a plural deity, even from the modern transliteration of the Hebrew term. Gods in the ordinary sense, and this is from the Strong's Concordance, the word Elohim, gods in the ordinary sense, but specifically used in the plural, thus especially with the article of the supreme God, occasionally applied by way of deference to magistrates and sometimes a superlative, angels. So Strong's itself agrees with us in our take that this is a pluralistic representation of a deity. It also seems to indicate that in fact it may have something to do with angelic beings. From this we may infer that the execution and governance of the original creation was done under the authority of the supreme God known as Yahweh by a group of angelic beings. We presented this back in the first two parts of this study. You can go back and you can look at that. Now, this identity is masked in the Latin, Greek, and English Bibles by the usage of the word God rendered as a single entity, a single pronoun. In Genesis 3:1, we see the presence of the being called in the English rendering the serpent, but more properly called Nakash or the Shining One. There is little dispute that this Nakash was an angelic being, likely part of the original group of creative angels. Even, maybe, the very leader of these beings. He would later be called Lucifer and may also be termed as Satan. You can go back to the show notes for the first part of this series and you'll find the information there. The term sons of God, appears in the Old Testament five times, twice in Genesis chapter 6 and verses 2 and 4, and then only again in the book of Job. And it is in the book of Job where we can make a connection to the Genesis creation and the sons of God. Job 38:6 says, "Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy." This places this specific group, the sons of God, at the creation, at the beginning, in Genesis, and directly connects them to the Genesis 1 narrative. So from even the most literal reading of the Bible, we can connect the Old Testament term sons of God to angelic beings connected to the original creation. Further details then must come from outside sources, ancient historical writings and mythologies. Again, I will assert the mythologies, and I consider the Genesis creation to be a composite mythology, offer richness of details that we cannot afford to ignore. Strictly speaking, the legends of the Anunnaki, also called the Anua or the Anunnaku, are derived from very old Sumerian, Akkadian, and Babylonian mythologies. The Anunnaki appear in the Babylonian myth, Enuma Elish, in the late version magnifying Marduk. After the creation of mankind, Marduk divides the Anunnaki and assigns them to their proper stations, 300 in heaven, 300 in the earth. In gratitude, the Anunnaki, the great gods, built Esagila, the splendid. It says that they raised the head of Esagila equaling Apsu, having built a stage tower as high as Apsu. They set it up as an abode for Marduk Enlil Ea. Then they built their own shrines. Now, this may actually take into account the accord of the Tower of Babel, and we're going to examine Babel in a separate study. I wanted to sort of isolate that information because it goes off as well into some other interesting stuff that I want to explore in later shows. According to later Babylonian myth, the Anunnaki were the children of Anu and Ki, brother and sister gods, themselves the children of Anshurad Kishar, sky pivot and earth pivot, the celestial poles, who in turn were the children of Lamaru and Lamu, called the Muddy Ones, names given to the gatekeepers of the Abzu temple at Eridu, the site at which the creation was thought to have occurred. So we have another rendering here for Eden, and that is called Eridu. Finally, Lahamu and Lamu were the children of Tiamat, goddess of the ocean, and Abzu, god of fresh water. Many such legends exist with great overlap and similarities, and we can infer their connections, which were handed down through multiple cultures over millennia. In the New Testament, we have six mentions of the sons of God rendered from writings attributed to several writers using slight variations of the Greek term for sons. The first mention, John 1:12 says, "But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe in his name." The Greek word rendered as sons here is technon. It means a child is produced, a child, daughter, son. Both mentions in 1 John 3:1 and 2 use this Greek word as well. Now, if we go over to another mention in Romans chapter 8:14, we read Paul writing, "For as many as led by the Spirit of God, they are sons of God." Here Paul uses the word huios, which means son, sometimes of animals, used very widely of immediate, remote, or figuratively kinship, a child, a foal, son. In the Greek of the other rendering, in Philippians 2:15, also attributed to Paul, it says, "That ye may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world." He uses there the Greek word technon. From a linguistic view, we assert that these terms are meant to be allegorical, metaphorical renderings that were intended to impart the message of co-sonship by believers with Christ. And you can see Romans 8:17 for that. Yeshua is described as being the Son of God and the only begotten Son of God. He himself claimed to be the Son of Man. All of these writings are means to connect the Messiah to the creation called man. So by these limited renderings of both Testaments, we have a very different rendering of what is titled the sons of God. The Old Testament, it is clear that the sons of God were angelic. In the New Testament, we can only link the same terms by a context that may have been referential. So attempting to sniff out a connection between the angelic sons of God in the Old Testament and the sons of God who are birthed by the Messiah, Jesus Christ, is really reading out of context. We have to read within the context, and we have to understand we're dealing with cultures that are millennia apart from each other. The fact that the ancient writers in the New Testament would have understood some of these connections means that it's meaningful that the term sons of God is used for believers in Christ, but it is not a direct connection or disconnect from the Old Testament renderings. We have to look at things, again, always in context. So why was there such a strong insistence by Yahweh on the purity of the Israelites? Even in the late narrative of Ezra, the period of the rebuilding of the Second Temple in the 4th century, before the Common Era, we see concern about the interbreeding of the Hebrews with those called peoples of the lands. Ezra 9:1 says this, "Now when these things were done, the princes came to me, saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands, doing according to their abominations, even of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. For they have taken of their daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the people of these lands. Yea, the land of the princes and rulers hath been chief in this trespass." So this is Second Temple period here. This is Reconstruction, Ezra and Nehemiah. And there seems to be a problem. And the problem seems to have something to do with genetics, with the mingling of the people, with the peoples of the lands. Each of these tribes listed in this verse were what we call mingled peoples. Listed in the scriptures, they include the Anakims, which would be the children of the Anunnaki, the Amorites, the Avims, Canaanites, Kaphtorians, the Emins, Gibberim, Hittites, Hivites, Horim, the Kadamites, Kenites, Kenizzites, the Nephilim, which were the original seed line of the giants or mighty men, Perizzites, Rephaim, Zanzumins, and Zebusites. You can use your Bible software or Strong's to find the references to all these ancient tribes right inside your Bible. What begins here in Genesis 6 is the beginning of the final stage of the fall of man. The Adamites, now dwelling in the lower dimensional realm, and I refer you back to the first show for that, dwelling in the lower dimensional realm with their prior celestial state taken away, their consciousness reduced by the constraints of third and fourth dimensional realms, and their divine DNA deactivated, begin to produce offspring. The fallen nature asserts itself early in the account of Abel and Cain. Genesis 4 gives us the lineage of Seth leading up to Noah. Man is carrying out his commandment to multiply. Suddenly, in the narrative beginning with Genesis 6, we have another twist in the plot. Let's read Genesis 6:1, since this is the pivot for this particular show. And it came to pass, when the men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives, all of which they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always dwell, shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh. Notice it says, He also is flesh. Yet his day shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sun, and no, back up a minute, we go right past this way too many times. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that. We can't just let that go, because the Bible will later spell that out as well. We continue here. When the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. Now, now again, you have to read the text of Genesis 6 carefully. There are little tripfalls in these scriptures that most Christian preachers, pastors, and teachers blow right past and never look at. The Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast. And, it's a conjunction, the creeping thing, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. Why is it that the word beast does not include the creeping thing and the fowls of the air? Is there not something else going on here? Are we not looking, perhaps, at hybridized species that had come out of the mingling that had occurred in the narrative of Genesis 6? This, for me, is probably one of the most important series of shows I've ever done, largely because about 15 years ago, I went to the pastor who was the head of the church I was in at that time, and I asked him very directly about Genesis chapter 6 and the Nephilim. The man's answer was unsettling when he said, Oh, we don't talk about that. We don't know what that is. This was a man that held three doctrinal degrees, two of them in biblical studies and ancient languages. This man could not and would not answer my question or entertain my question any further. This is the silence that has been placed on the topic by the churches. This is the silence that has come down around ever discussing the story of the fall in Genesis 6. And this is why what I'm teaching in both the first two parts and in this series are going to seem quite radical to a great number of Christians. I spent far too much time searching this out to hold back any longer. This is a journey towards understanding some things that are both very dark and yet very needful of being understood. So Genesis 6 gives us a little detail of the nature of this next level of degradation, except that it has seemingly... Genesis 6 gives us little detail of the nature of this next level of degradation, except that it has seemingly polluted the entire creation, so much so that God repents, regrets this creation, and decides to destroy it, with a notable exception. The book of Yasher, however, gives us additional details that inform this term of events, and it goes into what we call the hybrids. Yasher 4:18. And the judges and rulers went to the daughters of men and took their wives by force from their husbands according to their choice. And the sons of men in those days took of the cattle of the earth, the beasts of the field, and the fowls of the air, and taught the mixture of the animals of one species with the other, in order therewith to provoke the Lord God. And God saw that the whole earth was corrupted in its ways upon earth, all men and animals. So from Yasher here, we now see that not only is the seed of men corrupted, but the animals were also mingled in such a way as to produce hybrid zoomorphic beings. We call them by many names. We call them chimera, centaur, mermaids, griffins. The hybrid seahorse, the hippocamp, connected to the Greek god Poseidon, and the deities called Pan, the man-goat hybrid, and Minotaur, the man-bull hybrid. The legends and mythologies are simply too persistent to be ignored. This may explain the statement of God in Genesis 6:5, which says, "And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continuously." We're going to go over to the book of Enoch, book 1 called The Watchers. We're going to go to chapter 6, and I want to begin to go through a deeper narrative of what has occurred in the fall at this point and how we deal with reconciling material from outside books into the scriptural narrative. We go to Enoch chapter 6. And it came to pass that when the children of men had multiplied, that in those days were born unto them beautiful and comely daughters. And the angels, the children of heaven, saw and lusted after them, and said one to another, "Come, let us choose us wives from among the children of men, and beget us children." And Semjaza, who was their leader, said unto them, "I fear you will not indeed agree to this deed, and I alone shall have to pay the penalty of a great sin." And they all answered him and said, "Let us all swear an oath, and all bind ourselves by mutual imprecations not to abandon this plan, but to do this thing." Then swear they all together, and bound themselves by mutual imprecations upon it. And they were in all 200, who descended in the days of Jared on the summit of Mount Hermon. And they called it Mount Hermon, because they had sworn and bound themselves by mutual imprecations upon it. And these are the names of their leaders: Samlazaz, their leader, Arakabla, Ramael, Kukabalel, Tamlel, Ramlel, Danel, Ezekiel, Barakajil, Asazel, Armaros, Bartarel, Ananel, Zakel, Samspiel, Santario, Turo, Jom Jael, Sarawiel. These are their chiefs of tens. And all the others together with them took unto themselves wives, and chose for himself one, and they began to go in unto them, and to defile themselves with them. And they taught them charms, and enchantments, and cutting of roots, and made them acquainted with plants, and they became pregnant, and they bare great giants, whose heights were 3,000 ells, who consumed all the acquisitions of men. And when men could no longer sustain them, the giants turned against them and devoured humankind. And they began to sin against the birds and beasts and reptiles and fish, and to devour one another's flesh and drink the blood. Then the earth laid accusation against the lawless one. Chapter 8 begins the area where we see a little bit more unfold as to what was taught to man by these angels. And Azazel taught men to make swords and knives and shields and breastplates, and made known to them the metals of the earth and the art of working them. Now, here in this description of Azazel are some interesting keys as to the origins of war. Recall, we are told in the scriptures in Micah 4:3 and Isaiah 2:4 that man, quote, learned war. The art of war was taught to humans from the earliest times by the fallen ones. The prophecy of Daniel 11 gives us some subtle hints as well about the nature of these mighty men, and it is prophetic. Daniel 11:36 says, "And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is it is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate he shall honor the God of forces. A God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things." The God of forces is the God of munitions, and it links back to Malazim, also called God's protectors. This goes into an entirely separate area, but it's interesting to note. Man learned war from the gods. These were ancient forbidden arts that were closed off to man to keep man from killing himself and from exterminating his race. War was never intended to be part of man's presence upon the earth. Man was sent to be fruitful and multiply. The atrocities of war, they were taught to men by the dark legion of angels. Man was also taught to enhance themselves sexually by the use of cosmetics and jewelry to promote and inflame sexual desires. It tells us that Azazel taught, quote, "of the pleasant things of bracelets and ornaments, and the use of antimony, and the beautifying of the eyelids, and all kinds of costly stones, and all coloring tinctures. And there arose much godliness, and they committed fornication, and they were led astray and became corrupt in their ways. Simjaza taught enchantments and root cuttings, Aramoros the resolving of enchantments. Barakadel taught astrology, Kokabel the constellations, Ezekiel the knowledge of the clouds, Arachiel the signs of the earth, Shamsiel, the signs of the sun, and Sariel, the course of the moon. And as men perished, they cried, and their cry went up to heaven." And then Michael, Uriel, Raphael, and Gabriel looked down from heaven, and saw much blood being shed upon the earth, and all lawlessness being wrought upon the earth. They said to one another, "The earth made without inhabitant cries the voice of their cryings up to the gates of heaven. And now to you, the holy ones of heaven, the souls of men make their suit, saying, Bring our cause before the Most High. And they said to the Lord of the ages, Lord of lords, God of God, kings of kings, and God of the ages, the throne of thy glory standeth unto all the generations of the ages. Thy name holy and glorious and blessed unto all ages. Thou hast made all things, and power over all things hast thou. And all things are naked and open in thy sight, and thou seest all things, and nothing can hide itself from thee. Thou seest what Azazel has done, who have taught all unrighteousness on the earth and revealed the eternal secrets which were preserved in heaven, which men were striving to learn. Here we have an insight into the meaning of good and evil. Notice that these are eternal secrets preserved in heaven. This is innocence lost. Man not spiritually prepared to receive all these arts and crafts. It's continuing here in the narrative. And Semjaza, to whom thou hast given authority to bear rule over his associates, and they have gone to the daughters of men upon the earth, and have slept with the women, and have defiled themselves, and revealed to them all kinds of sins. And the women have borne giants, and the whole earth has thereby been filled with blood and unrighteousness. And now, behold, the souls of those who have died are crying and making their suit to the gates of heaven, and their lamentations have ascended and cannot cease because of the lawless deeds which are wrought on the earth. And thou knowest all things before they come to pass. Thou seest these things, and thou dost suffer them, and thou dost not say to us what we are to do to them in regard to these. We will not go into the great flood narrative in this study. It has some interesting twists as well, but to stay focused, I want to stay with this aspect of how the third stage of the fall continues to plague humanity. Why is it such a pivotal understanding, and even why these understandings have been hidden from the doctrines of modern Christianity? Indeed, they have been so dumbed down that we are unaware of how deadly this final part of the fall really was. We're going to look at Enoch's proclamation to the fallen ones, and I've called this Demonology 101 because it has to do with the origins of demons. Chapter 15 of the Book of Watchers follows up the account of the corruption of the humans by the fallen ones, and Enoch is told to go and proclaim to the fallen angels their final judgment. A judgment that will play out on the earth in the times of the great consummation, the end of the age of man. This is from chapter 15 of the Book of the Watchers. And he answered and said unto me, I heard his voice, Fear not, Enoch, thou righteous man, and scribe of righteousness. Approach hither and hear my voice, and go say to the watchers of heaven who have sent thee to intercede for them, and say, You should intercede for men, and not men for you. Wherefore have ye left the high, holy, and eternal heavens, and lain with women, and defiled yourself with the daughters of men, and taken to yourself wives, and done like the children of earth, and begotten giants as your sons? And though ye were holy, spiritual, living the eternal life, you have defiled yourselves with the blood of women, and have begotten children with the blood of flesh. And as the children of men have lusted after flesh and blood, as those who do die and perish, therefore I have given them wives also, that they may impregnate them and beget children by them, and that thus nothing might be wanting to them on the earth. But you were formerly spiritual, living the eternal life, and immortal for all generations of the world. And therefore I have not appointed wives for you as the spiritual ones of heaven. In heaven is their dwelling, and now the giants who are produced from the spirits and flesh shall be called evil spirits upon the earth, and on the earth shall be their dwelling. Evil spirits have proceeded from their bodies, because they are born from men, and from the holy watchers is their beginning and primal origin. They shall be evil spirits on the earth, and evil spirits shall they be called. As for the spirits of heaven, in heaven shall be their dwelling, but as for the spirits of the earth which were born upon the earth shall be their dwelling. And the spirits of the giants afflict, oppress, destroy, attack, do battle, and work destruction on the earth and cause trouble. They take no food, but nevertheless hunger and thirst, and cause offenses. And these spirits shall rise up against the children of men, and against the women, because they have proceeded from them. From the days of the slaughter and destruction and death of the giants, from the souls of whose flesh the spirits having gone forth, shall destroy without incurring judgment. Thus shall they destroy until the day of the consummation, the great judgment, in which the age shall be consummated. Over the watchers and the godless, yea, be wholly consummated. And now, as to the watchers who have sent thee to intercede for them who have been aforetime in heaven, say to them, you have been in heaven, but all the mysteries had not been yet revealed to you, and you knew worthless ones, and these in the hardness of your hearts you have made known to women. And through these mysteries women and men work much evil on the earth. Say to them, therefore, you have no peace. What we must take away from chapters 15 and 16 of the Enochian Watchers is the very origin of demons. Religion is not taught this correctly, and nearly all believers are totally clueless to the nature of what we call demonology. Demons are not, I repeat, not fallen angels. Demons are the disembodied eternal spirits which were destroyed in the great flood. Demons were the ideal of the Shining One's attempts to bypass Creator and sire beings who are both incarnate and immortal, a direct violation of the conditions given by Creator that mortal would not become immortal, quote, knowing good and evil, i.e. having the duality of evil in an immortal form in a three-dimensional creation. Because these beings could not be spiritually destroyed even though they were physically killed, they now exist in a dimensional rift where the spirit realm mingles with the physical creation. These were the godless creations destined to everlasting torture and vanquished from the presence of the Creator forever. So now you begin to understand the idea of damnation and what is called hell. The progenitors of these demons would now watch their own children destroyed and vanquished forever, their attempts to sidestep Creator resulting in an eternal grievous state. Jude 1:6 informs this a bit more when it says, and the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness, unto the judgment of the great day. These angelic beings do not give up. Even after the great flood, we would discover fallen ones would continue their dark genetic experiments, resulting in the tribes of the earth called the Mingled Peoples. These beings were vicious warriors, ingenious artificers. In fact, they became the gods upon the earth, ruling ancient civilizations from Egypt to Peru. Their megalithic sites stand to this very day around the world. We'll take a break at this point, let you digest some of the information, come back on the other side, and continue our study of the mingling. Here on the Threshing Floor, I'm Randy Moggins.
There is no such thing as time. You're already there, and you're controlling this cycle. You say, man, look what we found here. Einstein, or whoever you're talking to, Tesla, whoever you're talking to. Problems of the future can be solved by mankind because you create them. And you have to believe in the future. And what we have to do, we progress. We always progress. We try to. So the Sumerian tablets, they say the same thing like Genesis said, that there were chariots of fire that came into the sky. These beings got out of them, and they walked like a man, but they had reptilian features. They had snake-like eyes, a tail, and scales, right? And they were here, and they made slaves out of the people. And where they landed in is what the Bible calls Garden of Eden. They were trying to inbreed with the people here. The women would die, the babies would abort. But after 2,000 years, they started taking. The babies started being born and living. And they had tails, they had a few reptilian features of them. They could phase shift from one dimension to another dimension. And the people who know say it's the fourth dimension, it's the next dimension. Space is expanding. Their spirits coming from the center, right? We're going counterclockwise. There's supposed to be eight other universes going counterclockwise. And that's called super universe. You know, and love's always been a message. It just, circumstances happen, right? People freak out, just flat flip out, you know? Well, that's where Hitler came from. Hitler came from that. He was an outspoken, charismatic yeller. And all these people said, hey, we use this guy. Look at all these people listening to this guy. You know what I mean? So that's just one of the trips like that. You know, they still exist. And their bloodline goes back into Sumerian times. You know, they didn't call it reptilians. They didn't call it, but they did because they called it Satan. They called it the devil. And it's the same damn trip. It's a negative force coming in on a positive force because it's a third dimension. Right? And for it to solidify or to crystallize, it has to have both elements, right? And you have to keep it in balance, or it will one will destroy the other.
Welcome back to The Other Side of the Threshing Floor. I'm Randy Moggins. We're talking about the mingling. The third part of the fall. Most people who talk about the fall generally only discuss Genesis chapter 3. It is, in fact, a multi-dimensional, multi-part descent that humanity took from the time of the temptation of the woman, tumbling down through the present ages. I want to touch base here real quickly on some critical aspects of the study, because I think it's important that we provide apologetics with as much rigor and discipline as we possibly can. To those who seek to discredit the obvious connections between certain extra-biblical writings and the narrative I have mapped out so far, maybe a few examples of parallel texts will serve to sharpen the perception a bit. Because we have studied the methods of how this collection we call the Bible was assembled, we hold that there were deliberate attempts to hide key data, which explain much about the ancient battle in which humanity engages. These outside books give us much detail and insight into the received texts that otherwise might go unexplained if we didn't, at least at this point, examine them a little bit. In the King James Bible, Matthew 22:30 says, "For in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven." These are the words of Jesus. In Enoch book 1, the Watchers, chapters 15, we see, "Therefore I have given them wives also, that they might impregnate them and beget children by them, that thus nothing might be wanting to them on the earth. But you," speaking here of the shining ones, the fallen angels, "but you were formerly spiritual beings, living the eternal life and immortal for all generations of the world. And therefore I have not appointed wives to you. For as spiritual ones of heaven, in heaven is their dwelling. Enoch, Book 1, Watchers, Chapter 15, Verses 8 to 12 says, "The giants who are produced from the spirits and flesh shall be called evil spirits upon the earth, and on the earth shall be their dwelling. Evil spirits have proceeded from their bodies because they are born from men, and from the holy watchers in their beginning and primal origin. They shall be evil spirits on earth, and evil spirits shall they be called. As for the spirits in heaven, heaven shall be their dwelling, but for the spirits of the earth which were born upon the earth, on the earth shall be their dwelling. And the spirits of the giants afflict, oppress, destroy, attack, do battle, and work destruction on the earth, and cause trouble. They take no food, but nevertheless hunger and thirst, and cause offenses. And these spirits shall rise up against the children of men, and against the women, because they have proceeded from them." This is informed in the scriptures by 1 Corinthians 11:10, which says, "For this cause the woman to have power on her head," meaning the husband, "because of the angels." Mark 5:1 says, "And they came over to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gadarenes. And when he was come out of the ship, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no man could bind him, no, not with chains. Because that he had been often bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and the fetters broken in pieces, neither could any tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying and cutting himself with stones. But when he saw Jesus, far off he ran and worshipped him, and cried with loud voice, and said, 'What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? I adjure thee by God that thou torment me not.' For he said unto him, 'Come out of the man, thou unclean spirit.' And he asked, 'What is thy name?' And he answered, saying, 'My name is Legion, for we are many.'" This gives us an understanding of demonology, the origin of the demons, the power of the demons, the ability of the demons to afflict and oppress humankind because they are spiritual beings bound to the earth. In fact, the Book of Enoch tells us that they were born of the earth, and in the earth they shall remain. It appears that man has a destiny to ascend out of the earth into another dimension, perhaps a dimension from which he had fallen back in Genesis 3. But these beings are trapped in the earth forever, along with the angels and some other people that we're going to meet in the course of this study, to see the fate of the earth and what it means in terms of an eternal damnation. We're going to move to the final chapter of all of this. We want to talk about Azazel, Abaddon, and Apollyon, begin to understand the prophecies of the Book of Revelation with, I think, a dimension that has not been examined before. This study and the previous two shows can in no manner be a complete chronology or explanation of all the events that have transpired over the time span since the fall of man began. The composite of history is both historical and mythological. Most people on this planet know that there is something wrong. Most, professing a belief in an eternal creator, understand the basics of good and evil. But the large part of humanity does not understand that humankind, the creation existing on this present world in 3D space and 4D time, has been thrust into a battle whose outcome is yet to be culminated. Even professing Christians do not know the very nature of this battle, and as such, conceive of salvation being of something from their own carnal inclinations. If God sent a Messiah to save humanity, then what was the nature of the offense? We have all succumbed to the baser things of our natures. Does this God send us off to eternal damnation because we are humans acting out of a human existence. The doctrine of so-called original sin is an invention of the Catholic Church and was developed by the 2nd century Bishop of Lyon, Irenaeus, in his conflicts with the dualist Gnostics. It was never part of the Hebrew teachings, and it was extracted from paraphrases of the Apostle Paul in Romans and 1 Corinthians. The core of this great conflict over millennia lies in the three-stage fall of man. The final stage, the mingling, resulted in all the conflicts, plagues, wars, and oppressions to which humanity has been subjected. As is plain from the ancient texts, these fallen or shining ones, the gods themselves, have taught humanity war, vanity, sexual perversion, slavery, including hierarchical systems of rulership of one man over another, the arts of weaponry, city building, advanced systems of propulsion, basically most of advanced technology. They've been taught the art of genetic manipulation. The economic systems of money and commerce, our modern-day banking system, is a result of the ideal of a god of gold in the temples of the merchants. This is why Jesus threw the money changers out of the temple court. Nearly all the trappings of our modern civilizations are the direct work of these non-human entities, fallen angelic beings who left their first estate and descended into the realm of the fallen Adamites. This is well defined in Ephesians 6:12, where it says, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." Man is wedged between the demonic realms of the unseen rift, which affect, afflict, obsess, and possess him at the soul level. And the works of the rulers in the upper strata of the third and fourth dimensional domains, to this very day, we live in what is called the age of the Archons. And what is the true nature of this final conflagration called the end of days, end of the age, the tribulation, or end times? Well, the governments and leaders of this present age are corrupt, and man is indeed wicked on a scale not experienced since the dark days of the original Nephilim. We are told that this great final chapter holds a very dark fate for the sons of man, except for the work of one man who seemingly overcame the evil one. What does all this mean, and what is the nature of the events described by Yeshua in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and the mysterious revelation of Jesus Christ, the Apocalypse? The first thing we have to look at is this, and this is something we established back in the third day teachings many years ago, when we were still looking at Scripture from what I consider now to be a pretty fundamental level. There is no such thing as an Antichrist in Revelation. Let's read Revelation 9:11. What an interesting number that is, huh? It says, "And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon." Abaddon, of Hebrew origin, a destroying angel. The word also means perishing. Concrete, it means Hades and destruction. If we look at the Hebrew, abad, it means to wander away, to lose oneself, by implication to perish, to not escape, to fail, or to lose, by extension to be undone, utterly to be void of, to have no way to flee. It says in Revelation 13:18, "Here is wisdom, let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. Again, we've touched on some of this in previous shows. In the Old Testament, 660, the word is ephah, in the sense of an asp or venomous spirit, a viper. This is a metaphor. Genesis 3:1, "Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, Yea, hath God said, ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" Modern Christian apocalyptic studies continue to promote the idea of a man called the Antichrist. But no such person exists inside their own scriptures. Because of this misidentification by nearly all Bible prophecy teachers, including some with which I have been associated, we have a patchwork of interpretations which run from the absolutely insightful to the completely ludicrous. Yet all of them are incorrect because they fail to identify the nature of the two key players in Revelation, the beast and the false prophet. In fact, dear listeners, you are in the midst of the latter. The false prophet is the entire delusional system of Christianity in this present age. It includes as well Judaism, Islam, and all of the variant forms of the world's religions that have come down through the ages, religions that have been separated from the teachings of their original progenitors. The Christian Church does not teach what Jesus Christ taught. The modern Jewish constructs do not teach what was written in Torah, in the law, and in the canons of the apostles and prophets of the ancient Hebrew texts. With some rare exceptions, all Christian prophecy teachers, writers, and students have failed to identify the former entity, the beast, because of their inability to grasp that their holy books were all altered to hide the very identification they seek within its pages. The key to understanding the battle of the final days of this age of the Archons is to go back to Revelation from a wider perspective. There is an entity who must reappear. This entity is so powerful that it can deceive the very elect if he could. Sadly, there are few elect, as most modern Christians living on the cusps of the age can identify him. This being does have a name, and it is even a modern cultural illusion. Let's look at it. Azazel appears in the role-playing game Dungeons and Dragons, a demon appearing in the thriller film Fallen with Denzel Washington. Azazel appears as an avenging angel in the ABC Family miniseries Fallen. He is a demon portrayed with yellow eyes by different actors, a character on the CW television network's drama Supernatural, a Nephilim from the British TV series Hex. He also appears in the popular film of this year, X-Men First Class. Amazing that the occult know who Azazel is, yet Christians are clueless. The word appears four times in the Old Testament, the name Azazel, in Leviticus 16, 8, 10, and 26, where the ritual of the Day of Atonement is described. After the priest has made an atonement for himself in this house, he is to take two goats on behalf of Israel. One is to be a sacrifice to the Lord. The other is to be a scapegoat. For example, the goat for Azazel. In all appearances of this word, it has the preposition to attached to it, meaning that the scapegoat is sent out to Azazel. The word has been variously understood and translated. The versions of Septuagint, the Symmachus, Theodotion, and the Vulgate have understood it to stand for the goat that departs, considering it to be derived from two Hebrew words, ez meaning goat, and Azazel to turn off. By associating with the Arabic word Azala, banish, or remove, it has been rendered for the entire removal. Now, if you go back and you look very carefully at the definitions that I broke out on Abaddon and Apollyon, you're going to begin to see the connection that's occurring between Azazel and the beast of Revelation. What we want to do now is make better sense of the description given in Revelation of this cryptic being. In Revelation 17:8, it says, "The beast that thou sawest was, and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wander, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was, and is not, and yet is." these people whose names were not written in the Book of Life from the foundation of the world, who are they? I've said many times on the show that I believe that we live amongst beings who are not living souls. I believe that many people that you encounter in life have no souls, they have no eternal disposition, they are simply beings, much like cardboard figures that are walked out onto a stage play to populate a cinematic presentation. Most people on this planet are in the Valley of Decision. Maybe yet their names can be written, but they are not, and so they do not have understanding. Revelation 17:11 says, "And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition." A cryptic reference in the book of Nehemiah connects this beast to the dragon. Nehemiah 2:13 says, "And I went out by night by the gate of the valley, even before the dragon well, and to the dung port, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates thereof were consumed with fire. Then I went on to the gate of the fountain, and to the king's pool, but there was no place for the beast that was under me to pass." The rabbinic interpretation is generally considered this word to designate the place to which the goat was sent, a desert, a solitary place, or the height from which the goat was thrown. The final possibility is to regard this word as designating a personal being so as to balance the Lord. In this way, Azazel could be an evil spirit, and we see that in Enoch 8:1, 2 Chronicles 11:15, Isaiah 34:14, and Revelation 18:2, an evil spirit standing logically in the antithesis to the Lord. So in a sense, while we may describe this being as Antichrist, the identification is not precise. Azazel is the missing piece in understanding this piece of revelation. He is not a man. He is an angel. He is part of the first ones. In his Bible dictionary, James Hastings states, "Azazel must have been an evil spirit, sufficiently distinguished from the rest, in popular imagination to receive a special name, and no doubt invested with attributes which, though unknown to us, were perfectly familiar to those for whom the ceremonial of Leviticus 16 was first designed." Now, we would differ with Mr. Hastings in this. He has failed to make the distinction between angelic beings and evil spirits. We talked about Demonology 101 in the first part of the show, and I told you very specifically the origins and nature of demons. So, again, even in the scholarship of James Hastings, we see that most Christians, most Christian writers, most scholars still do not understand what evil spirits are in distinction to fallen angels. Let's look at Azazel in the book of Enoch. In one account of the fall of the angels in the book of Enoch, Azazel, or Asael, as the Qumran texts pronounce it, is the leader of the watchers who educates humankind of heavenly secrets that lead humankind to sin. These teachings include the making of weapons of war and preparing of cosmetics which enabled the women to seduce the angels. The angels then charge Azazel before the Lord with crimes of revealing the heavenly secrets which mankind was not supposed to know. Raphael was then assigned to punish Azazel by binding him hand and foot and throwing him into the darkness among the sharp and jagged rocks, where he would remain until the day of judgment, when he would be hurled into the fire. The story then claims that the whole earth has been corrupted by Azazel's teachings, and by his own actions we write sin upon him. In other words, sin is ascribed to Azazel. It was because of Azazel's teachings that God sent the flood to destroy the evil in the world, and even the souls of the giants, so that all evil would be wiped away from the face of the earth. It says in 1 Enoch 8:1, "And Azazel taught the people the art of making swords and knives and shields and breastplates, and he showed to their chosen ones bracelets, decorations, shadowing of the eye with antimony, ornamentation, the beautifying of the eyelids, all kinds of precious stones, and all coloring, tinctures, and alchemy." Azazel is the chief of those fallen ones who taught humanity the ancient forbidden arts. over to Leviticus chapter 16, verse 8. Again, this is a long study. There's no way to make this short, people. If we're going to understand this stuff, we got to do it from depth. We can't do it from the shallowness of the Christian church or from most of the Christian teachers out there who don't bother to do the wet work that's necessary to understand this. Like I said, this is a very long show. But if you just simply go through it and go through the notes, which I'm going to put up with it, you have a great pool of knowledge by which you can begin to actually navigate ancient texts and modern prophecy pretty clearly. Leviticus 16:8 tells that the Lord ordered his high priest Aaron to place lots upon two goats, one marked for the Lord and the other marked for Azazel on the Jewish Day of Atonement. The goat designated by lot for the Lord is to be used as a sin offering, while the goat designated for Azazel, quote, shall be left standing alive before the Lord to make expiation with it and to send it off to the wilderness for Azazel. Aaron was to lay both hands upon the head of a live goat and confess over it all the iniquities and transgressions of the Israelites, whatever their sins, putting them on the head of the goat, and it shall be sent off to the wilderness through a designated agent. Thus the goat shall carry on it all their iniquities to an accessible region, and the goat shall be set free in the wilderness. Leviticus also says that he who set the Azazel goat free shall wash his clothes and bathe his body in water, after which he may re-enter the camp. So from these passages in Leviticus, it would seem that Azazel is conceived of as a personal being, as lots were drawn for the Lord and for him. Also, Leviticus mentions that Azazel lives in the wilderness, as do the seraphim. Because of this ritual, Azazel is known as the scapegoat. The goat that is sent to Azazel is not a sacrifice, but a symbol. There is no longer any unexpiated sin. Both the goat and the man who leads the goat away are unclean, and the only way the man re-enters the camp is by washing his clothes and bathing. So again, we've talked about how humanity fell and all of the great sins of the world. In this Old Testament understanding, I think we get a different picture of the expiation from guilt, that all sin was laid upon the Azazel goat and sent out into the desert, and it was sent off as a means of expelling evil from the tribes of Israel. I want to look at Azazel from another perspective. This comes from a book called The Apocalypse of Abraham. So again, another outside text, but it provides us with a backdrop where we begin to understand a little bit more about who this Azazel is and why he's important to us. In The Apocalypse of Abraham, Azazel is portrayed as an unclean bird which came down upon the sacrifice which Abraham prepared. This is in reference to Genesis 15:11. Quote, birds of prey come down upon the carcasses, and Abraham drove them away. So let's read this. This is the Apocalypse of Abraham, chapter 13, verses 4 to 9. And the unclean bird spoke to me and said, what are you doing, Abraham, on the holy heights, where no one eats of drinks, nor is there upon them food for men? But these all will be consumed by fire and ascend to the heights. They will destroy you. And it came to pass when I saw the bird speaking, I said this to the angel, what is this, my Lord? And he said, this is disgrace. This is Azazel. And he said to him, shame on you, Azazel, for Abraham's portion is in heaven and yours is on earth. For you have selected here and become enamored of the dwelling place of your blemish. Therefore, the eternal ruler, the mighty one, has given you a dwelling on earth. Through you, the all evil spirit is a liar, and through you, are wrath and trials on the generations of men who live impiously. So again, we have this idea here, this is pretty critical, that Azazel is the source of evil, he is the tempter, and his place is given in the earth, while man's place, as descendants of Abraham, is given to ascend above the fallen angels. Do you see this? Revelation 18:2, it says, and he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great has fallen and has become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. The Apocalypse of Abraham associates Azazel with hell. Abraham says to him, "May you be in the firebrand of the furnace of the earth. Go, Azazel, into the untrodden parts of the earth, for your heritage is over those who are with you." This is the idea of God's heritage, the created world, largely under the dominion of evil. It is shared with Azazel. Azazel is also identified with the serpent which tempted Eve. His form is described as a dragon with hands and feet like a man on his back, six wings on the right and six on the left. Again, this is from the Apocalypse of Abraham. Revelation 20:14, "And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire." This is the second death. We'll look at Enoch 10:1, and it says, "Then said the Most High, the Holy and Great One spake, and sent Uriel to the son of Lamech, and said to him, Go to Noah, and tell him, in my name hide thyself, and reveal to him the end that is approaching, that the whole earth will be destroyed, and a deluge is about to come upon the whole earth, and will destroy all that is on it. And now instruct him that he may escape, and his seed may be preserved for all generations of the world." And again the Lord said to Raphael, "Bind Azazel head and foot, and cast him into darkness, and make an opening in the desert which is in Dudael, and cast him therein. And place upon him rough and jagged rocks, and cover him with darkness, and let him abide there forever, and cover his face that he may see not light. And on the day of the great judgment he will be cast into the fire. The whole earth has been corrupted through the works that were taught by Azazel. To him ascribe all sin." I think as you begin to go through these verses, we now begin to understand the beast that was and is not and yet will be. We see from the excerpt that we just read that Azazel's punishment was to be bound and cast into an opening made in the desert and sealed up. He was to remain in this place until the time of his judgment, when he would then be cast into the fire. When we examine the punishment later decreed for the remainder of the angels who sinned before the flood, we get a little more information about this place where Azazel and the other angels were imprisoned. Enoch 54:3, "And there mine eyes saw how they made their instruments, iron chains of immeasurable weight. And I asked the angel of peace who went with me, saying, For whom are these chains being prepared? And he said unto me, These are being prepared for the hosts of Azazel, so that they may take them and cast them into the abyss of complete condemnation. And they shall cover their jaws with rough stones, as the Lord of spirits commanded. And Michael and Gabriel and Raphael and Phanuel shall take hold of them on that great day, and cast them on that day into the burning furnace, that the Lord of spirits may take vengeance on them for their unrighteousness in becoming subject to Satan and leading astray those who dwell on the earth." That's from the Apocrypha and Pseudepigraphia of the Old Testament by R.H. Charles, the version of Enoch, chapter 54. Jude chapter 6 says, "And the angels who did not keep their own position, but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains in deepest darkness for the judgment day. Likewise, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which in same manner they, the angels, indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural lust, serve as an example, undergoing a punishment of eternal life." That's from the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible. That sounds a little different, but I wanted to read that because it's a little more plain. It gives us a very plain text sense of what happens in Jude chapter 6. 2 Peter 2:4, "God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them in chains of darkness to be reserved for the judgment." 1 Peter 3:19, "He, Messiah, went and preached to the spirits in prison, who formerly were disobedient, when once the divine long-suffering waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is eight souls, were saved through water." Revelation 17:8, "The beast that thou sawest was, and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, and go into perdition. And they that dwell in the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was, and is not, and yet is." Enoch 10:7, "On the day of the great judgment, he, Azazel, shall be cast into fire." So now we have connections between Azazel, Apollyon, Abaddon, the beast that was and is not and yet will be. It says that Azazel, Apollyon, the beast, shall ascend, and yet he'll be cast into hell. So we have to put pieces of a puzzle together. We have to understand the identifications. I see little dispute at this point that the book of Revelation is speaking of this angel, Azazel. I had a conversation last year with a man whom you've heard on the show. His name's Chris Tyerman from the Chronicle Project. A few months after I met him, Chris sent me something quite stunning. And he sent it to me because he knew of my work, not just in the threshing floor, but also the fact that I was doing work on UFOs and extraterrestrials on off-planet radio. What he sent me is an Aramaic translation of Matthew 24, verses 5 through 11. I'm going to read it, and I'm going to read it very slowly because it's difficult to parse because it was done using the system that Chris and his team have developed. I will give you the paraphrase of each segment as we go through it, and then we'll summarize the study because I think something has been hidden from our eyes that was revealed quite innocently by somebody who did not go looking for this. This is from the Chronicle Project, The Beast and the False Prophet. This is Matthew 24, verses 5 and 11, which were taken from an Aramaic translation. Aramaic, very close to Hebrew, so they were able to actually parse this. It says, Matthew 25, verse 5, Oasis, to be entering inside, name mine to declare, to speak known as to anoint, and to proceed to distort with you. And with those, this is to increase, to proceed to the hearing, the war being continuing, and a fellowship continuing, the host being continuing. The warning, to turn, to proceed, to devote, being to instruct, aforementioned period of time, to enter, to mourn a great amount. Nothing, the two end, and so to rise up nation above nation, and that queen above queen, and so to be reasoning, being the clamor, being continuing. I'm sorry when I'm reading this, it sounds like nonsense. I ask you to go and look at this on the show notes, but I needed to read it so that you understand. This is a translation that was done using a very specific system. It has to do with the work of the Chronicle Project, and you can find that work at chronicleproject.org. I want to read the paraphrase from Matthew 24, verse 5. It says, to station inside as an oasis, people flock to the area from the water and respite. These false teachers appear and give this. One of the few stations in a church is the pastor. The host, being continuing, is a host of angels. It was foretold in the book of Enoch that the abyss where the angels would be imprisoned would hold them and the demons until the end of days. The book of Revelation says that the anti or copy Christ beast arises from that pit. The angel named to be this being is Azazel, the abomination who causes desolation. It is interesting to note, quote, only queens are left. In Luke 11:31, it tells us that the queen of the south shall rise up in the judgment with the men of this generation and condemn them, for she came from the uttermost parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, a greater than Solomon is here. Revelation 17:5 says, and upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, mother of harlots, and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman, the queen, drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. Matthew 24, verses 3 to 11 says, and he sat upon the Mount of Olives. The disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world, or the age? And Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and deceive many. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. All these things are the beginnings of sorrows. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you. you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall arise and deceive many. Matthew 25 continues in the paraphrase from the Chronicle Project when it says, "Hunger shall cut across the world. Earthquakes will increase. All is defined. These items will definitely happen. You will be bound to oppression. They will reason ways to disgrace all of the steps to God synonymous with my name." What Chris notes in his paraphrase here is that this is an important variation from any other translation. It agrees with the revelation of John that a false prophet would arise and deceive the majority of people to follow Azazel. Revelation 16:13, "And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet." Revelation 19:20 says, "And the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them, and that had received the mark of the beast, and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast into a lake of burning fire with brimstone." Revelation 20, "And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night." This is the conclusion of this present study on the fall, part 3, the mingling. The final stage of the mingling is what has occurred with religion, what has specifically happened with Christianity, because humankind has been deceived by the very religions that were sent to give you the information to be free. The church has mingled itself with false spirits and false doctrines and false prophets. Its books are corrupted. Its teachings are ashes. The people following the churches today around the world have been deceived into believing many different doctrines, many false prophets, many, many prophetic scenarios, and none of them stop to consider the horrible truth, the return of the first ones, the return of the chief first one, the fallen angel Azazel, the very scapegoat upon whose head all sin has been laid, all of the iniquities of humankind brought by the fall that happened in Genesis chapter 6. For those who continue to track with me and track with this show and the Off Planet Radio show, I think you begin to see the overlap and the similarities. I think you begin to understand why this is a quest and why we need to understand what's going on in our world right now and why the deception is so thick and why humanity is in so much darkness and deception. It also gives you an understanding of what hell really is and for whom it was deemed, and the fact that many will choose to be deceived and therefore follow Azazel and the fallen band of angels into the pit because they did not take the time to hear and learn the truth that is plainly spoken and plainly taught. I'm Randy Moggins. This is The Threshing Floor. Truth is out there. It's inside you. Keep looking for it.